Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, good morning.
We started the lesson already.
You've started. You're already conversing there. We're actually going to take a few steps back from actually where the conversation has been so far, which is you know, that's good. That means you've got frames of reference already well engaged here, and then today we're going to kind of get a whole frame of reference together and dig into this a little bit deeper in the coming weeks. So this month and next, it should take us about January and February to walk through building the good life for all, transforming income inequality in our communities. This book is going to look at specific practical approaches to addressing income inequality. The author I'll introduce to you, I don't have his picture, although I suppose I could have. The author is Shannon Jung. Shannon actually was one of my brother's seminary professors, because he went to a better school than I did. Shannon writes about the practices of sort of spiritual life, specifically around food and around community, and his emphasis has always been on rural ministry. So he's got a very specific kind of deeply rooted sense of ministry. And he's writing here about the pros and cons of different approaches to support mutual flourishing, and we're going to talk about what the word flourishing means in this context. And as we look at these different approaches, we're also going to look at the ways that Covenant is and isn't engaged in each of these different strategies, each of these different dimensions of supporting flourishing. So I've distributed all but two of the copies that we ordered back in December. If you did not order a copy in December and you would like one, just let me know. I think most of you did order copies in December and now you have them. But if you'd like a copy, let me know. I'm happy to place a little additional order. So the overarching idea of this book is going to be that there are multiple different ways to address income inequality, and that they don't all work in the same way, in the same contexts. They have different sort of pros and cons and trade-offs. And so we want to know what strategies work, what strategies don't work in a given situation, because they all work sometimes. They all fail at some other times, and wisdom is knowing which thing to apply at any given time. So we want to respond wisely to the needs of our community. Today I want to talk about the introduction and chapter one. If you have not yet read the introduction to chapter one, you're okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try to summarize this introduction by reading some of, just sort of, I'm going to hopscotch through the text, reading sentences that I think will help kind of keep us all squared away on what Shannon is talking about. So from the introduction, "As a teacher and pastor, I have been drawn to those who lacked daily necessities. I have examined and taught about poverty, have thought about how pastors might address financial issues in their communities, have even written about how to deal with hunger issues. Maybe that came from being the child of educational and dental missionaries in the Congo. I have been involved in housing ministries, food banks, and community organizing. As that work has gone on, I have come to realize that it is not just those officially below the poverty line who are struggling. As Americans, welcome.
Morning.
As Americans, we are dealing with a new economic reality. It is not just the homeless and unemployed who live hand to mouth. The working poor are living paycheck to paycheck. Their futures are anything but secure. The reality of the number of employed, hardworking people who nonetheless struggle financially degrades our collective sense of well-being. Our well-being is eroded by the sheer magnitude of this problem and the plight of lower-income working people. This group is twice as large as the officially defined poor. Increasingly, the middle class is becoming the working poor, and the economic plight of millions of Americans has become a major national concern. So Shannon then goes on, he teases out, this is on page 3 of the introduction if you want to sort of watch him do this, but he teases out the way that income inequality and sort of economic instability, particularly among the working poor, we'll talk a lot about what that means. He teases out the ways that related to both the Bernie Sanders campaign in the 2016 presidential election and the Donald Trump campaign in the 2016 presidential election. So, quickly.
Quickly, yes. Are you going to say anything, or do you need to say anything about segueing from the last session about poverty in Jesus' time to this time? That's a rhetorical question.
Keep those connections in the back of your mind.
I'd be interested in what you
mean. They are not irrelevant here. Yeah. Shannon says, I have 3 goals in this book. First, to show that we are all interdependent. That'll be our focus this week and next. And second, to demonstrate that the growing income gap impacts our spirituality as well. So this is a church book. This is a book written to and for Christians. And then third, to introduce 4 strategies for addressing income instability in our own context. And he lays out here what 4 strategies we'll look at. We will look at relief, charity, giving people what they need. We'll look at self-help, which is the teach a man to fish approach. Cultural formation, how do we shape the cultural values that we bring to this work, and the cultural values that the wider culture brings to its assumptions about income inequality. And governmental action. How do we advocate for, in what contexts is governmental action a helpful approach to income inequality? And then finally, the last session is a getting started. What do we do now that we've explored this? God has called us to love our neighbors as ourselves, and so we begin by getting to know who those neighbors might be, which is the focus of the first chapter. We're going to talk about 2 people by name. These are both sort of composite people, Alice and Alec. So Alice is sort of the archetype of this. Alice is someone who is asset limited, income constrained, and employed. It happens that Alice is a typically woman's name, and it also happens that the majority of those who are part of the working poor are women. So that this doesn't become just a conversation about gender, although it should also be a conversation about gender, Shannon also gives us the name Alec, so asset limited, employed, constrained, so that we've got a little range of genders here. So what does it mean to be asset limited, income constrained, and employed? We'll take it backwards. Employed means you have a job that you get paid for, right? And the majority of those who live in poverty and those who live below the sort of the living wage threshold, the majority are employed. They do work and get paid for it. The question of being income constrained, though, is that you don't have enough cash flow to make those ends meet in the at the level that we are used to, right? To be asset limited means that you don't have that cushion. You don't have that that padding underneath you for when the income doesn't make the ends meet. You know, if you've got assets, then you can get through some time when the ends don't meet because you've got that cushion to hold you for a little while. If you don't have the assets, that income constraint becomes a lot more painful. So there are reports that suggest that almost half of us will be working but living in a financially shaky situation for some period of our lives. About half of us will be Alice or Alec at some point in our lives. A United Way study looked at the survival line. A group that is making more than the poverty line, which is based on the cost of food primarily, but less than the basic cost of living in a number of states. Shannon lives now on the central west coast of Florida, so most of his examples come from around Sarasota. The United Way found that 44% of the households in Florida's central west coast experienced financial hardship, but only 15% were technically under the federal poverty line. So there's this big chunk of people, a third of the population of the central west coast of Florida, are living in that gap between the poverty line and the survival line. Deb, you were, before we started, you were citing the number $16 an hour with both parents working.
Right.
So two incomes at $16 an hour to make the actual cost of living in Iowa. I assume that's for a certain family size.
A family of four.
Kids. So two parents, two kids, two incomes at $16 an hour to actually make the cost of living, food, housing, and so forth, in Iowa. So what's the minimum wage in Iowa? Right. So there's a big gap between a minimum wage job and a survival wage job. Now, there are great conversations to have about minimum wage. We are going to forward most of those to strategy four. But those are great conversations to have, and we should have them. Now, the point is that Alice and Alec are our neighbors. They are people that we are interdependent with. So the welfare of our community, which means the welfare of us as people in community, depends on the welfare of Alice and Alec. Though we were born with different abilities and into divergent circumstances, we are essentially interdependent. And so that we don't think that Alice and Alec are only somebody else, we also come back to that number. Nearly 60% of Americans between the ages of 20 and 75 will spend at least 1 year below the official poverty line. And a full 75% of us will experience a year below 150% of the poverty line. So, you know, within reach of the poverty line. And that's solidly below that survival wage. Nearly 15 million children in the country are poor. 6.5 million are extremely poor, living below half the poverty line. The Children's Defense Fund estimates the long-term costs to society at $500 billion in lost productivity, government assistance, healthcare, and incarceration. Related to that level of childhood poverty. And we have important cultural values that that speak into this. And Shannon lays out what he reads as really widespread American values, which are related to Christian values but are not necessarily the same, right? So traditional American values such as fairness, such as care for all children, such as equal opportunity, mobility, that's economic and geographic mobility, and non-discrimination, work and making a contribution, national destiny, and the value and dignity of each life. So the effects of poverty and the effects of income inequality are also in conflict with what Shannon identifies as widespread American values. He does allow that there is also constructive inequality. There is some value to knowing that you can get ahead, right? Knowing that you can change your position in the world. He says, this is not a soak the rich book. It does not believe that any simple sort of fix is possible. The affluent and the poor are both in distress, however different the two are, because the material poverty of some causes spiritual poverty in all if we do not take action.
I think that that feeling of just trapped and there's no way I can get out of it mm-hmm. is much more prevalent probably than when I was young.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and without good numbers in front of me, I hesitate to make some of those cross-decade comparisons because I don't know for sure, but I think the general sense is that it's that sort of our economic world has felt shakier. Mm-hmm. In the past couple of decades than it felt decades prior.
One of the wisest statements I got from any of my professors was, he says, I had to wash dishes during between the summers of my college.
Uh-huh.
He said, just the fact that I knew that this, I didn't want to do this.
Uh-huh.
And there was another something I could do.
And there is something you can do,
A lot of people nowadays don't think there is anything else they can do.
I think there's a solid piece of that, and there's a one of the things that that we should also spend a little bit of time with in this. I think probably especially when we get to the values, the cultural formation week. I think we should probably talk a little bit about sort of the place of higher education in the cultural world that we inhabit. Because there's a piece of sort of the malaise of sort of millennials especially is the idea that I can go to college, I can graduate with a degree that supposedly trained me for a job of which there are not enough. And at the same time, there are a bunch of jobs that I'm overqualified for. Right? There's a whole lot that I wouldn't bother applying to because I've got too much education to work in a factory, and there's a whole complex of issues going on there,
and also the complex issue of people who have a blue collar job just aren't
Right. That somehow working in a factory is ignoble, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
We saw that with the actor from the Cosby Kids when he was working at Trader Joe's and something.
Oh,
And it became this big social.
Yeah, a guy got shamed for having a job.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
Nathan?
Yeah.
And one of the things that Betty raised was did we look at it differently? And I think that in terms of our opportunities, as you look around at kind of all white people, mm-hmm. I think when we grew up, we knew that the opportunity was there.
Yes.
If we chose mm-hmm. to do something, We could accomplish it if we invested. I don't know if that's true for a lot of non-white people and people who grew up differently than we did economically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah.
People who've made a mistake in their lives.
Yeah.
And people who have made a mistake. Yeah. So keep us alive as well to the way that the racial history of the country plays into this. Shannon touched really briefly in one of the sentences that I read for you on the connection between poverty and incarceration. That growing up in poverty has a really, really negative effect on your tendency to enter the criminal justice system. So does growing up as a person of color. And those effects, they run together a lot, but they also multiply each other. Pay attention to the way that our whiteness affects the way that we picture where is opportunity, when was there opportunity as compared to when is there not opportunity, and what are the odds of us making a mistake that is going to land us in jail as opposed to a person of color making a mistake that's going to land them in jail. Shannon wants us to know that there's a cost to all of us. So there's that economic cost. There is also this cost in terms of the way that we are interrelated. All of us do better when everyone enjoys a basic level of well-being. So this first conversation focuses on our first argument that an ideal state of economic justice would reflect the interdependence of all citizens in our environmental and social life. So he's not saying everybody has to be at some particular economic arrangement. He's calling our attention to the idea that this sort of widening income gap, widening opportunity gap, is detrimental to the ways that we interrelate, interdepend, and support one another.
Nathan?
Yeah.
I think one of the big things that, one of the biggest mistakes that society made a number of years ago was taking out of the school systems sending everybody in the college direction instead of in the I'm trying to think what the word is for some reason.
Vocation.
Where you see an electrician or a plumber or some of those kinds of jobs, those became almost like the status of success was college and then being a computer programmer or a inventor or whatever it happened to be, and they took away the dignity and the and the value of doing something with a craftsman type work,
right? Yeah,
which we're now paying for because there aren't enough electricians and plumbers and everybody. And I noticed that a lot of DMAC is trying to bring some of this back, but you still have to turn it around to the point where it's an acceptable part of life and it's not looked down on.
Right, and yeah, and so
yeah.
So there's a piece of that fits in that cultural formation week, right? That when we talk about how do we as still very much participants in the dominant culture, right? And in a dominant cultural institution for all of sort of the status and prestige that white Christianity has in most cases rightfully let go of, we are still a powerful institution. So how might we shape the culture in a way that acknowledges the value of these jobs that I'm not qualified for, right? You know, I've got a master's degree. I am not qualified for a whole lot of jobs, in addition to the ones that I'm like overqualified for and wouldn't bother applying to because they wouldn't hire me because I'm too qualified. There are a whole bunch of other jobs I am not skilled enough to take on. Now, how does that relate to this idea of interdependence? How does that relate to the idea of understanding ourselves as interdependent with the working poor or with the people who fix our electrical?
You start by treating the person who's fixing your electrical in an honorable way.
Right, treating the person who's fixing your electrical in an honorable way, or the person who is cutting up your meat, or the person who is washing your car or building your car, right? Yeah.
Fixing your furnace.
So there's a relationship to be had between we who can't fix our own furnaces and they who can fix our furnaces.
An anecdote that I read long time ago was about a brain surgeon who was home on his day off and had a plumbing problem. The plumber came and fixed the problem, presented the bill, and the surgeon looked at it and said, "Wow, I'm a brain surgeon. I don't make that kind of money." And the plumber said, "Well, I didn't either when I was a brain surgeon."
Yeah.
I like that.
Nice.
That's good.
So,
well, you know, it's very same thing though. There will be, say, like a mechanic who really, he really knows the insides and outs of anything mechanical. Mm-hmm. You give it to him, he can fix it. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I don't know how many people really appreciate that ability and that knowledge.
Right.
Yeah, especially some of the well-heeled who look down upon
right.
that sort of thing, yes.
Right, and so it's that tendency both both interpersonally and sort of at a more tangible level, that tendency to look down upon. That's one of the places that brokenness manifests itself, right? That when we as the affluent, and we are not all the same flavor of affluent in this room, I don't want to pretend that we are somehow all one thing and they are all some other thing. But when we, the more affluent, look down at someone who is less affluent, looking in that direction has those interpersonal relationship problems, that it has that tendency to change the way we treat someone when we're actually talking to them. It also has a tendency to change the way that policy is made, the way that that contributions are recognized, the way that opportunities are distributed. Mm-hmm. John?
I will posit that our whole economic system is set up to push people downward, and I'm not going to get into a socialist rant at this point. But if I were in business school and I posited, put forth a business plan for my new business in entrepreneurship class, and it didn't recognize that I was going to make more money either for myself or my shareholders if I did something, I would make less money if I did something dumb like hire people at reasonable wages instead of going down to Lowe's, I don't know whether they do this or not, but the local lumber yard, and pick up day laborers at minimum wage or less with no benefits every day. That might be my responsibility to my shareholders as things sit. And I think that there's each one of us, but there's, and I know you're talking about collective, but we participate in collective pushing down and don't even realize it.
Right, and so there's a cultural thing. There's also there's going to be some interplay with the idea you just set out in terms of relief on the one hand, but especially self-help, right? Making it possible for someone else to lift themselves up. And the ways that those relate to sort of the real bottom lines of your business. There's actually there's a growing sort of field within business looking at specifically how can we as business be ethically responsible. But let me actually bring it to this discussion question. And if the I know the background is a little hard to read against. I'm going to see whether I can lighten that even a little bit more. I just thought it was pretty. So this question of, you said the whole system is sort of built to push someone down.
And we don't know it or we ignore it, was my point.
So let's acknowledge it. What factors prevent people from thriving even when they are employed? What makes it hard for someone to thrive even when they are employed?
I automatically denominate myself as an old guy if I talk about the day that many of us remember when you could start at the bottom and work yourself up and have some kind of reasonable job security. That is a factor that keeps people from thriving.
So a lack of job security, you know, gone are the days when you get your foot in the door at the bottom of some corporation and you will retire from that same corporation with a pension. I mean, defined benefit pensions are almost completely dead, says a guy with one. But that whole idea, that whole lifetime career is very much gone. And that idea that you can keep working up, even if you hopscotch companies, I mean, which is the, people are now hopscotching careers rather than individual corporations.
Well, I think there's some factors against people just societally in that, for example, our public transportation is not all that great.
Uh-huh.
So that when people need to get to work, this was one of the reasons that Cross Ministries moved to where they are,
mm-hmm.
because they're on the bus line. Prior to that, they weren't. And mm-hmm. People would, if they needed to mm-hmm. have some assistance, would get off, say, at university and have to walk and carry whatever it is back. The other thing is that there's very little free child care.
Mm-hmm.
So if a parent needs to work, then what do they do with their children? And mm-hmm. how expensive it is for everybody right now. It doesn't just mean, not just people below the poverty line, people, anybody trying to make it, your child care is one of the most expensive things there is.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And the other thing is I noticed too is when they keep saying everybody should try to eat healthy, do you know how expensive it is to eat healthy?
Right.
And you know, you walk around a grocery store and just all of the expensive stuff is really out there, the milk and the vegetables and everything. But if you want to get on carbs and tons of sugar, walk down the middle aisles.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so the cheapest...
Some of those things, I think they're between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, so the availability of transportation, the cost of transportation, even if you own your own vehicle, it's expensive to get around. It's also, there's a flip side of that because, of course, from a climate standpoint, it's not expensive enough to get around. The cost of childcare, the cost of food, and particularly the way that cheap calories versus nutritious calories, you know, they're not the same things.
I'm hoping we're making a little dent in that expensive outside circle of the grocery store with our garden mm-hmm. and with...
Oh, I think
right.
that's true, but then you still have to have people be able to get to it or to...
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it, some of it's so interrelated.
Yeah, which is why there are no simple solutions, right?
Right.
Because the expensive food around the perimeter of the grocery store relates to the difficulty of growing actual food as opposed to growing corn that can be processed into something or soybeans that can be processed into something, which is what those center aisles of the grocery store are filled with. So that there's a cost disparity, there's a subsidies disparity, because lettuce is not subsidized, corn is. And there's the question of how do we make that economics work without shortchanging the people who need food to be relatively inexpensive. So this is a deeply interconnected set of problems. Can I help you?
No.
Oh, okay.
And also shortchanging the farmers who who raise the corn and beans.
Right.
Well, I'm going to say, even if you do have a job, you may have family responsibilities, or you just don't have the assets to get further education either, so you're sort of stuck where you are.
Right.
Even if you want to,
Which relates a little bit to the way that, for instance, a bachelor's degree is table stakes for getting into any kind of job these days, right? So there's an additional barrier at the bottom of the labor market for just getting in. Jerry?
Yeah, a term that I found useful is discretionary income, because without discretionary income, it takes one event that isn't necessarily catastrophic, but for that person, if you need new tires, then not being able to get them is a catastrophe.
Yeah. I have seen numbers, I don't have them ready to hand, but it's kind of a shocking proportion of the American workforce specifically who don't have the number of dollars in savings that they would need to recover from a brief hospitalization, right? Because what's a brief hospitalization cost out of pocket?
50?
A handful of thousands of dollars if you've got really good insurance and the hospital stay is not too long. And who's got a handful of thousands of dollars in savings?
And most of these people, if they don't work, they don't get paid. They don't have savings.
Right. Okay, so let's turn to ourselves for a moment. What interconnections do we depend on for our own financial security? Where do we depend on those interconnections with our neighbors? And where do we feel most vulnerable within those interconnections?
Maybe I'm going back to it. Times before dinosaurs again, but growing up in Mason City, there was definitely a better good side of town and a poorer side of town, and the poorer people all worked at the packing plant or the two cement plants.
Okay.
They would, I'm sure, not in all cases, but in many cases, help each other. And that is something you just don't see anymore. Government has taken that over.
So there's a history you're remembering of individuals helping each other when times got tight. I've seen it happen still, because times get tight with or without government assistance. Where do you as individuals, as families, recognize your own interconnectedness with others in our economic life?
Well, I'm connected to my family, my grown children. You know, if they don't have the discretionary money,
right?
You know, grandma.
So you find yourself connected as a source of support for those who need the extra. Extra asset, whatever it is, to get through. Yeah.
And something I think we've grown up with, I are not poor, I know, with my family and everything. You didn't need or want all these things. And everybody, and even the kids, as they grow up, think, well, my parents had all this. You know, they had the DVD players and all that equipment and everything, and they think, well, I should start out with that.
So we're going to talk next week about consumerism.
Yeah.
Because that is that's deeply related to the ways that we deal with actually our economic vulnerabilities, and the fact of the way that we are interconnected. Tell me more about how we are interconnected.
We used to be able to depend wrongly.
Bring me to today. I don't want to hear about how it used to be.
Well,
right now, today, how are we economically interconnected?
Right now, we are more interconnected because we no longer have the ability to go back to family for...
So family was an interconnection. How are we interconnected today?
Well, my point is that we're only interconnected if we can rely on the government or somebody.
Okay. So there's a missing interconnection.
Yeah.
In terms of that sort of social safety net.
Yeah.
For many, not necessarily for all.
Sure.
Okay. How else are we here in this room interconnected?
With members of the covenant with each other.
Yeah.
Where if, I don't know so much for financial security, but I think with emotional and spiritual security,
mm-hmm.
we depend on each other that way. If you're
yeah.
referring strictly to the bottom one, I'm not sure.
Uh-huh. But...
I don't know. I think we probably also depend on each other financially to keep the lights on and to keep the building and to mm-hmm. pay you. And
right.
If we weren't able to rely on one another to do that, we wouldn't have covenant.
Right. So there's a level of financial interdependence built into the emotional, social interdependence that we live in as the church. Because it does. It costs money to do church the way we do church. It doesn't cost money to do church in an absolute sense, right? But it does cost money to do church in the way that we do it. And so,
if you're a member of an association or a charitable group or have friends or neighbors that aren't maybe as well off as you are, I mean, you're more apt to help them out or understand
mm-hmm.
more what's going on.
Yeah, so some of that social interconnection is sort of an avenue into recognizing where those financial interconnections are. I actually need to make that the last word in light of time. Here's some homework for you. Most of the time your homework will just be to read if you're interested in reading. So read chapter 2 for next week if you're up to that. Here's homework for everybody. Talk to your neighbors this week and find out who Alice and Alec are, those asset limited, income constrained, employed folks in your community. Your neighbors, either literally
or in a
wider sense.
Sounds,
and find out what their needs are. Find out where a church might fit into that. So there's your assignment for the week.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.